This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, Family Security Committee will come to order, and we have a very long agenda, so we're going to start. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we're going to start with your bill, Senator Lynch, Senate File 2708.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here with Senate File 2708. Mr. Chair, to begin with, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment as an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape for discussion today.
We will hand it out, but we don't have quite a quorum yet, so we will vote on it. But so just present the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2708 modifies the special education chapter of law by allowing a mental health professional as defined in the Children's Mental Health Act, specifically clauses 1 through 4, to make a diagnosis and determination of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder for purposes of identifying children with a disability. Mr. Chair, when I was approached about this bill, I viewed this proposal kind of through the lens of some reform and what could we do that would be better for children and families, while at the same time, we have so many discussions in this division about what are things that we can do to make the process more efficient, provide fewer hoops to jump through, if you will. And this provision, I think, does this. We want children that need assistance, that we know that the earlier that they are identified, the better it is for them. And we also know that there are a number of practitioners that are presently qualified to assist in that, and this is modifying the law to account for that. I want to be very clear that there's nothing in this legislation that changes the scope of practice for any practitioners. Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask that Stephanie Ochaki, the president of the Minnesota Social Workers Association, to provide some additional information to the committee.
Ochaki, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and just go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephanie Ochaki. I am the president of the Minnesota School Social Workers Association. Our organization's mission is to promote the academic success of students by reducing social and emotional and environmental barriers to learning. As such, I'm here to speak with you today regarding Senate File 2708. We are advocating for a change in law that, as currently stated, puts undue burden on families navigating between the mental health and education systems as they try to get help for their child. Our goal is simple. We hope to reduce barriers that families must surpass in order to explore help for their child at school. Current law demands that if a family whose child has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, is involved in an assessment for special education under the other health disability category, assigned ADHD diagnosis from a medical doctor, nurse, or licensed psychologist is one criterion for qualification. Before last year, the law required that the ADHD diagnosis must come only from a medical doctor. Last year, legislation expanded to include licensed psychologists and nurses. This expansion of mental health professionals whose ADHD diagnosis can be utilized for the other health disabilities special education assessment has been a move in the right direction by the legislature. However, as school social workers poised at the juncture between school and the community, we see that barriers still exist. Many children see qualified mental health professionals in clinics and community counseling agencies, such as LICSWs, Licensed Independent Clinical Social Workers. Including these qualified mental health professionals, who are already defined by state statute, will prevent a family from having to incur additional costs of both time and money. School social workers in our state, working closely with families in this situation, have heard complaints about having to make additional appointments, withstanding additional wait times to get in for appointments, inability to secure cover to costs of transportation or to secure transportation to appointments, and having to pay additional co-pays or out-of-pocket payments if the family does not have insurance for the appointments. These additional barriers can be enough to prevent a family from being able to get the second ADHD diagnosis, which is a critical piece of qualification for special education services under the other health disabilities category. As school social workers, we see parents who have children that have their ADHD diagnosis and who may benefit from special education services. We believe asking a family to see a medical doctor, nurse, or licensed psychologist to obtain documentation of ADHD undermines the right of the family to choose the type of professional they feel can best work with their child and their family to address their specific problems and their specific needs. For example, when a family is already working with an LICSW, licensed independent clinical social worker, who has utilized differential diagnosis per clinical standards of the profession, asking the family to essentially double up on the diagnoses for documentation purposes of the school can slow down or even stop the process of assessing a child for special education services under the other health disabilities category. A school social worker in our organization had shared they had been working with a student who had been diagnosed with ADHD by an LICSW. Both the parent and teachers had concerns about the student's progress with the curriculum at school. And after interventions done in the general classroom did not prove progress for the child, a referral to special education had been made to explore other health disabilities. As the special education evaluation team worked with the teacher and the family to gather background information, the process came to a grinding halt, because the ADHD diagnosis that the child had was from an LICSW. The parent was informed that the diagnosis had to be signed off by a medical doctor, nurse, or licensed psychologist. Unfortunately for the family, they were no longer covered by health insurance, and due to job loss, did not have the means to cover the out-of-pocket expenses. As a result, the special education evaluation for other health disabilities could not continue. The child was not evaluated for services that could have provided the necessary accommodations for the student to have academic success, and they unfortunately continue to show no progress with the curriculum at the close of the school year. Now, had the ADHD diagnosis from the LICSW been recognized in order to assess for the special education category of other health disabilities, the teacher working with the student would have learned valuable information about the learning needs of the student in the special education assessment summary. If the student had qualified under the other health disability category, they would have received accommodations at school to meet their learning needs. Both outcomes would have been used to help the student learn and grow in their academics. The changes we are presenting will not increase the number of children diagnosed with ADHD, as the requirements for a diagnosis of ADHD are not changing. Nor will the number of children receiving special education services under other health disability change, as ADHD alone, the diagnosis does not automatically qualify a child for special education services. An assessment and evaluation will still need to be completed in order to determine if the ADHD impacts the child's education and learning. Our proposed changes are meant to ease the burden on families who are already struggling to understand and deal with the challenges of having a child who has ADHD. Because school social workers connect with students, their families, and the school, we see that allowing medical doctors, nurses, licensed psychologists, and LICSWs to have their differential diagnosis of ADHD count for educational purposes when exploring other health disability will systematically reduce barriers to academic success. We can ensure that no family is unable to explore the supports available to them at school because of extra runaround and costs associated with the doubling up of service. So, in closing, on behalf of students, families, and school social workers across the state and Minnesota, I very much appreciate your time and consideration on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Uchocki. Questions from the committee? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, my assumption is that the individual who is providing testimony has some good knowledge of the current situation of assessments on the ethnic disproportionate representation of children of color that have been assessed and diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. So I would like to ask a few questions related to that, because I am concerned about making some decisions that could be of detriment to this particular population. So I have several questions, and the first one is that I would like to know if you know the actual proportion of African-American children and Latino children and African children that are currently diagnosed in schools with attention deficit disorder today.
I do not know that answer, and what I would share with you is that the number of students who are diagnosed with ADHD would be information that is different from children who are qualified for other health disabilities with the diagnosis of ADHD in schools.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but you actually do know that there is a significant increase, right, in the assessment and diagnosis of attention deficit disorder into those two populations.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would like to respond that I know that is something that education in our field of social work is concerned with. What I am answering to you is that the number of children who have diagnosis of ADHD in public schools in Minnesota is a different number, possibly, than those who are qualified for other health disability in the state. And your question was about the number of children who have attention deficit disorder in the state.
So let's take another one then.
Yeah.
Let's talk about another mental health, because I can go down the list, Mr. Chairman, if you indulge me. So let's talk about autism, another mental health. Do you know the incidence of autism among African children in the schools today?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would say again that that answer is, what I can answer to you is that the number of children who have any specific mental health disorder might be a different number than those that are receiving special education services in school. It's through the special education evaluation that it is determined whether or not a diagnosis, whether it's ADHD or autism, which you have spoken of, that is impacting the student's learning, and if then they are qualified to receive services for special education. I can tell you that I do not have the answers for the number of children that are qualified in these different areas with me.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, what I wanted to do here is really bring up a point that for me is very, very important, and that is that there is a need to do a very thorough review of this issue. And unfortunately, I'm not ready to support this change right now because I do not believe that we have done so. And I will be absolutely delighted to work with you on trying to figure out how do we do that through this bill. The reason being that the disproportionate assessment and diagnosis of children of color in the system today is a very alarming issue, and we need to pay attention to it. A large number of children who are attending the Minneapolis School District, and probably your district as well, are children who actually are entitled to these benefits that we are discussing here today. And interestingly, a lot of these children not only get services that are mental health related services, but they also receive, in the case of children that do not speak English, some assistance with services for ELL, and that's significant money. So there is a concern among many parents in immigrant communities that children are being assessed by professionals who really do not understand some of the significant barriers that children that do not speak English actually face in the schools today. And I believe that that issue is an issue that we need to review, and I would very much appreciate if we could use this opportunity to do that.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres Wright. Senator Torres Wright, I'm not, recognize and appreciative of your concerns. I think that perhaps we're complicating what is a much larger discussion. I'm not sure that this, I know that this bill is not designed to address that very large issue. What this bill does is very, very simple. Currently, and I'll refer you to lines 1.14 of the original bill, currently a licensed physician, an advanced practice nurse, a licensed psychologist, and with the adoption of the amendment in this bill, we would add a clinical social worker. Those practitioners would be able to make that, to complete that assessment. And as Ms. Oshaki pointed out, by completing that does not in any way mean that that student is eligible nor ineligible for services. That's another step, a different process. So we are simply adding, giving clinical social workers, along with the physician, along with the advanced practice nurse, along with the licensed psychologist, it's another option for families to help them maneuver through what can be a very challenging system for many of our families. That's all this bill does. Very simple.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, just a point of clarification. Does this new diagnosing authority extend to prescription?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to yield to Ms. Oshaki.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is just lining up what it says in statute, that licensed independent clinical social workers are able to make mental health diagnoses, one of which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Prescriptions, as you spoke of, are medication, therapeutic treatments through medication is still under the direction of medical doctors.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I was qualified to make it. I would like to insert physician assistants into the list of professionals who also are qualified to make the diagnosis and determination. And I believe you've had a conversation about this, Senator Lynch. So, Mr. Chair, I'll move on line 15.
First, we have to adopt Senator Lynch's amendment. We did not have a quorum at the time. We now do. Senator Lynch moves the A2 amendment, which you all have now. The clause is 1-4. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevail. Senator Higgins.
Okay, Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 15, after the word nurse, comma, insert physician assistant, comma.
Licensed
physician assistant. I assume.
Mr. Senator Chair,
Lynch.
Senator Higgins, I was approached about this a few moments ago.
Ms. Abdur-Holden, did you wish to speak briefly?
Let's hear some a testimony on this. Mr. Chair, didn't feel that this would be problematic for the bill.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I believe it is current practice. So,
Ms. Abdur-Holden.
Mr. Chair and members, Sue Abdur-Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. We were fine with using the current definition of mental health professional because we know that as part of that particular training, they have training on how to do a diagnostic assessment. But we don't have, we don't include physician's assistants in the definition of mental health professional because they don't necessarily have the diagnostic assessment training. Even with the nurse practitioners, we've said that they've had to have additional training in mental health because of that, because that's an important piece. Just because you have the healthcare training may not mean that you have the mental health care training. I wasn't aware of the amendment today. I mean, I'd be happy to talk to you about it some more, but we would initially just have some concerns about adding them.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I would also have concern about the amendment. You know, we have enough difficulties today with pediatricians who are trying to provide mental health services to children and oftentimes need more professional help to be able to adequately deal with a child, and a physician assistant has far less training than a pediatrician.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Lehman would like to speak.
Mr. Lehman, briefly. Ms. Abdur-Holden, did you have some?
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Lehman on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. I did approach Senator Lynch just a few moments before the hearing. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to connect with her earlier this week. Physician assistants in Minnesota currently practicing in pediatrics, family practice, and community health utilize a variety of standardized screening tools to evaluate patients for both ADD and ADHD within their health systems and within their collaborative agreements with their physicians to establish a diagnosis and treatment plan. I was in contact with Becky Ness, who's the co-chair of the Professional Practice Committee of the Physician Assistant Association recently, and she gave an example, personal example of a patient she had treated. A 14-year-old girl presented having trouble in school, having a variety of issues. Some assessments were done, screenings were done, diagnosis of ADD was developed, medications were prescribed. The girl did very well, and today she's a junior in college doing very well. So this is not something that all PAs do, but within some practices, particularly pediatrics and family practice, this is something that they are doing currently. They do have the ability to prescribe under Minnesota law, so they have what's needed to both diagnose and for screening purposes and then to come up with treatment plans. So we would respectfully encourage the support of Senator Higgins' amendment. Thank you.
Senator Higgins, you've moved the amendment. You're pursuing it. Senator Lynch, any comments?
Mr. Chair and members, I feel like I'm sort of running on the fly with it. I am very much so. It's true. They nailed me as I was walking in here this morning. And in light of the testimony, I wonder if it would be more appropriate if physician's assistants worked along the lines of being incorporated into the Mental Health Act, if that's something that you want to fall under. That's outside of the scope of this bill. I guess what I'm suggesting is that I think to incorporate Senator Higgins' amendment into this bill today is
too broad.
Too broad.
On the Higgins amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Further discussion on the bill. Is there anybody who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill or concerns about the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, senators, and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miner. I'm an LMFT. Worked in the community for many years. I'm the president-elect of the association, the Minnesota Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, which has 1,500 licensees in this state. Our association has more than 1,400 members. And I came here today to speak in support of the bill. I still support this bill, despite what I think to be a tragic amendment that happened today that excluded LMFTs and LCPCs. I really was moved by Senator Torres Rey's concerns about racial disparities, which is exactly why I'm in support of this bill. Because the people who are working in the community, the people who are standing behind me, who are all LMFTs that are placed in the schools, that are having the opportunity to do true differential diagnosis, who are seeing kids in the context of their schools and their families, and are working with those communities and with those families and gathering all of the essential information to do a true differential diagnosis are now suddenly being excluded. I think it is a right step to add LICSWs from our sister association, but I would tell you that you are to exclude LMFTs and other mental health professionals is exactly what creates racial disparities. It is exactly that kind of fencing off and forcing our children. I have 8 grandchildren in the Minneapolis public school system, and I will tell you that it is exactly that kind of thing that creates racial disparities in access to mental health services and also the racial disparities in access to school services. Yes, there is an overdiagnosis, but that's what happens when you send people outside their community and put them on 6-month waiting lists. That's what happens all throughout the state, up in Indian country and on reservations where people are forced to drive long distances and meet with people that don't understand their culture, and they're the people who are going to diagnose them. Senator and school social workers, I think that you were moving in the right direction, but I think your amendment today actually is quite a setback. And I still speak in support because I believe it would be a step in the right direction for LICSWs to be included. I hope you will reconsider that amendment at some other point, and we plan to take that to the House. Like I said, we have 1,500 licensees in this state, and we're represented in every senatorial district in this state. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Well, you know, no, actually, I'd like to say a little bit more. I mean, it is the very people who staff the community mental health services that are being excluded. It is the people that are at the Guadalupe Alternative Program, the mental health professionals that are in the schools. It's the people at Reuben Lund Family Services, where I was the clinical director for 20 years. Those mental health professionals who suddenly are being told that, you know, despite the fact that they have the training, they're federally recognized and recognized by this state and have the competence to do differential diagnosis, that their diagnosis doesn't count. You know, that's what you're saying to the Washburn Child Guidance Clinics. That's what you're saying to the Edison Collaborative, who are the mental health professionals who stand behind me today. I support this legislation. I hope that those questions about racial disparity and access, which is really what drives this and makes this bill so worthy, is reconsidered.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, apparently this was an author's amendment before I came in, and I didn't hear why you were offering it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, first to clarify, no one is being excluded. The statute as it currently exists does not include mental health professionals. Okay, so no one is being excluded. The reason for the amendment, Senator Berglund, was in working on this bill, there, as it was originally written, there was opposition from the MMA, oppositions from pediatricians, opposition from the Psychologist Association, and in further working with the stakeholders, I felt that a way to move forward, and my intent was to, again, make the system a little easier for children and families, that sometimes you can't bite off the whole piece of the pie at once. And so a way that I felt that we could move forward was to simply add the addition of the clinical social workers, which is essentially what my author's amendment did. And I'm not by and large, the larger group of stakeholders wasn't ready to expand that any further. And I made the decision that I felt that it was important that we be able to move forward. I think this is a step in the right direction. And those that might wish to be included can continue to work on that effort.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, my question is, if not in this bill, because I don't think that this bill provides the scope, but if you were to get the authority that you're seeking, do you think that there would be a greater or a lesser incident of ADHD?
I think under the current legislation, as it is now written, that you probably get a higher incident of misdiagnosis because you don't have the relational context. People are not seen in the context of their families or communities. And again, the original offer on this bill did include the people who are gathering that information in their differential diagnosis and are probably going to be more accurate in that diagnosis, in both directions, though. Identifying children earlier who actually do have ADHD and would benefit from services, and also in finding out what are the other issues that might be in play, what are the other interventions that might be tried before labeling and diagnosing a child with this disorder. And I think that that's what drives racial disparities in both access to mental health services. I worked in the community. I've worked in Minneapolis for many, many years, and, you know, I've watched these issues. go unanswered for many years. So in answer to your question, I think that you would have more accurate diagnosis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying with an expansion to cover the authority that you're looking for, you would get a correct diagnosis, not necessarily greater or lesser, but more accurate.
I think you would have inclusion of the people that are closest to gathering that information to do a true differential diagnosis, yes, indeed. And I think that you would have a more accurate diagnosis. And I'd also like to point out that mental health professionals, by federal law and by state law, are authorized and qualified to do the full range of differential diagnosis. This original exclusion that left it only to physicians was about simply accessing special ed services. It was a step in the right direction to begin to look at inclusion, and I believe, Senator Lynch, that your heart is in the right place, and your amendment is still, again, we'll still support this bill, but I think that, you know, it's fundamentally flawed to again bring in that exclusion, and it will again silence the voices of community and family and deny access.
Thank you. Senator Lynch, Ms. Ochocki.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, what I would just like to add again is that this bill is not about increasing the number of children who have diagnosis to ADHD. It is about making sure that when a family goes to a professional, such as an LICSW, to have their child assessed and to address problems and concerns that they're seeing at home and school, that diagnosis could be recognized by the school if they should look into the evaluation for other health disabilities. I will also just add that nothing in this law states that families cannot choose to see an LMFT or an LPCC.
Further discussion from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Senator Lynch, I wonder if you would be willing to support an amendment to your legislation to take care of some of the concerns I have with respect to the diagnosis of immigrant children. And I am working on it as we speak. But what I would like to add with your support is that on line 1.16, after subdivision 27, before is qualified, I would like to add who is knowledgeable of the cultural background and who. And so the sentence will read, a licensed physician, an advanced practice nurse, a licensed psychologist or mental health professional under section 245, etc., who is knowledgeable of the cultural background and who is culturally competent or who is knowledgeable of the cultural background and who is qualified to make a diagnosis and determination. So either one, there are some questions with respect to cultural relevance and cultural competency, but I think in social work practice in particular, the actual definition of cultural competent is much well defined and embraced that perhaps in psychology and other fields. So culturally competent could be simply a good addition to that.
You should probably ask Senate Counsel if that accomplishes what you want to accomplish.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if you indulge me, I think Senator Corin's suggestion to consult with counsel is a good idea.
Why don't you work with that? Senator Lynch, while they're working on that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, the section of statute that's identified in the bill in 1.15 to 1.16 defines mental health practitioner. And there are a number of components that go into that definition. I will read in part what the provision says. This is subdivision 26. is fluent in the non-English language of the ethnic group to which at least 50% of the practitioner's clients belong, completes 40 hours of training in the delivery of services to children with emotional disturbances, and receives clinical supervision from a mental health professional at least once a week until the requirement of 2,000 hours of supervised experience is met. It continues on. And so, Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm suggesting is that I think contained within the mental health practitioner definition, if you will, that the issues that you raise are included there. And I think you have clearly articulated the concern and, frankly, the problem with the disparities overall in our special education population, particularly perhaps in ADHD. I think that's a much larger discussion outside of the scope of this bill. And so I would be inclined to not consider that a favorable amendment.
Senator Torres-Ray, what are you?
Senator, at this point, this is a very, I feel very strongly, as you know, Senator Lynch, and since the language does not conflict, I do not believe that this is an issue that that actually is, you know, taken away from the language that it exists. Is very, it very much, I believe that the language will not conflict. So I would like to pursue the amendment since it's already defined. So I would like to take a vote on amending these to include, after subdivision 27, culturally competent as an additional piece. And it's inconsistent with, it is consistent with, as you said, Senator Lynch, with the language that is already in statute anyway. So I would like to pursue a
Senator
vote on that.
Torres-Ray, need clarification. First of all, did you intend to take out the clauses 1-4, or you're not?
Well, that's
it. Where did you want that inserted?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have it inserted right after 27. So I would like to insert who is culturally competent and who is qualified. So the words that I would like to insert in 116 is who is culturally competent and who will be the additional language that will be inserted into that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, to be clear, the A2 amendment that was adopted reads on line 1.16, what the committee has before it at the moment.
That's better.
Subdivision 27, comma, clauses 1-4, comma.
Do you want to leave in there, in other words?
Absolutely, yeah.
After the four, then.
Yes, I don't have that in front of me. Correct. Thank you, Senator Lynch. That is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Senate Counsel, can you read that amendment one more time?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, on page 1, line 16, before is, insert who is culturally competent and who.
Yes, qualified. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to speak on the content of the amendment that's being offered, pro or con, but I believe that the second who is problematic because it seems as if this statement is trying to define who is qualified, and the amendment is putting into place a language that says we already know who is qualified. And so I think the last who in Senator Torres-Ray's amendment is confuses the intent of the amendment. And I just want to get clarification on that, but I think that's the case.
I think either way is fine.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Hand. That is, you know, I think it's as a matter of semantics. So absolutely. I think the intent here is to incorporate the additional qualification that I am concerned about. And I want to make sure that I clarify this to you, Senator Lynch. My concern is the actual diagnosis of a specific group that it has been, the diagnosis of this specific group has been growing in an alarming way. So what I want to make sure is that we address that, and I think that just incorporating, actually the both whose may be irrelevant. Maybe Senator Higgins has a recommendation, but I just want to make sure that culturally competent is incorporated so that who could be actually both could be taken out.
Mr. Chair, may I try and help?
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, if we move, if instead of inserting Senator Torres Rey's amendment where she has it, if on line 14, after the word A that starts the new sentence, a licensed physician, da-da-da, if we put culturally competent there, so a culturally competent licensed physician, AP nurse, psychologist, da-da-da-da-da, then I think gets to where Senator Torres Rey wants us to go.
Mr. Chairman.
Then that becomes the list of who is qualified.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I guess even, I mean, the correction to the amendment causes me even greater concern than the original place that Senator Torres Rey planned to put her amendment. You know, my daughter was diagnosed in the second grade with ADHD. She left first grade at the 39th percentile in reading. She left the second grade at the 95th percentile in reading. And I was a pediatrician who half of his practice was kids that have ADHD, so he wasn't like, you know, kind of whistling in the wind. He studied this a lot. And he said to me, you know, I said, I am very nervous about giving my daughter this medication that you're prescribing. And he said to me, try it for 2 weeks. And if you don't think she's benefiting from it, I will be the first one to help you figure out what else we can do. Well, you know, she benefited from it. And I am concerned that there are not going to be enough people who meet your definition, Senator Torres Rey, and that there will be children that will of color who will not get these services or this diagnosis, who would benefit from having it and having the treatment that can benefit them so they can succeed in life.
Senator Torres Rey.
Senator Berglund, Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I know you know this perhaps than anybody else, being in the Senate for quite some time, having hearings on this issue, and being a parent, actually, who has gone through this. Actually, we have said that for as long as I have been in this country, for 22 years, that maybe one of the problems that we will create by advocating for competent people of color who can do this diagnosis is that actually we'll end up in rationing the system. And I have heard that now for 22 years, and the numbers of workers who are being trained and recruited to do these assessments continue to be the same. We have made no progress. Though the number of children in the schools who are being diagnosed and who have these problems are actually predominantly people of color. So we have not invested in higher education, and we have not invested in any field to be able to increase the number of professionals of color who can do this work. This is particularly problematic for the great number of children who are coming from Africa today, who are refugees. And by the way, Senator Berglund, the overwhelming majority of children who are being diagnosed in the Minneapolis school system today happen to be Somali and Ethiopian. I do not know if these children have a higher incidence of autism or any of these attention deficit. I do not know. But I clearly know that we need more professionals who speak Somali and who speak Ethiopian. And certainly we have a tremendous need for professionals who speak Spanish and are able to communicate with parents and children. So yes, Senator Berglund, I am very also concerned about that. But my response is not going to continue to be, well, let's don't do anything about it. So I hope, Senator Berglund, that together we can work to make sure that we increase the numbers.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Rae, I agree with your assessment that we need more professionals of color in the medical fields. But I just don't think this is the way we're going to get it to happen. Earlier this year, I had a meeting with the University of Minnesota about foreign-trained physicians and trying to get a program for them so that they can get into an internship, so they can get into practice without having to go through medical school all over again in this country. I think that would help us with what you're talking about. I don't think this will. I think this will simply leave kids who need services out of being able to receive those services. I mean, if you can't even see a licensed physician to get a diagnosis unless that person is culturally competent, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, unless your definition of culturally competent is different from my definition, it doesn't mean that the physician or the provider is only of the same culture that you are. It is that you have the provider has a recognition of how the diagnosis, how treatment, how families all work together in different cultures may be different. It isn't that you would only see a person of your own culture.
Well, I understand that, but I don't believe, Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I don't believe passing this amendment means all the licensed physicians in this state who treat children with ADHD are going to go get cultural competency training.
Should.
Just an observation that we're getting tied up in more and more issues on this bill, and I'm wondering if it might make sense, and I'll ask the author if she's willing to, if we set this bill aside for today and would bring it back next week. I think there's a whole lot of issues going on here, and it's multiplying the more we talk.
Mr. Chair, to counsel, is there a statutorily defined definition of culturally competent?
Not that I know of.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move forward with a vote on the amendment, there's not a statutory definition of culturally competent.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there is or not. That's something I need to research.
Can I hear the amendment read again one more time if we're going to take a vote on this amendment?
Page 1, line 16, before is, insert who is culturally competent and.
Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Cora. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we table this bill. Looks like it needs further work.
There's already a motion on the table.
This is a higher motion.
Yes. And I'm going to suggest.
And non-debatable.
Yeah, it's not debatable motion. I'm going to suggest we just lay the bill over and take it up next week. And that way we can have some discussions among people who have interest, and there are a number of issues that are here, and I think we can bring the bill back, and rather than vote on it, I'm just going to lay the bill over for a week.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you all. I hope everybody involved in this can have their discussions,
your
and maybe we'll be ready. I don't blame anyone for not being prepared for it. It's just the discussion is expanding in more ways the longer it goes, and I think we'd be better off. Thank you. With that, we will take up Senate File 1137, Senator Higgins.
It's not going to be that simple. This was supposed to come.
Hello.
Senator Higgins, Senate File 1137.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1137, the Epilepsy Patient Protection Act, allows people with epilepsy and their physicians to better manage and monitor the use of their anti-seizure medications. It would state that before substituting an anti-epileptic drug for the prescribed drug, There would need to be prior consent from the patient and a notification to the prescribing physician within 10 days of the substitution. I would like to point out at the very start that this is in no way meant to say that generic drugs are bad or aren't useful in many cases. But for this bill, we want informed consent of physicians and patients before substitutions of anticonvulsants are made. I'm going to turn it over to Kevin Goodnow to explain the bill farther.
And Mr. Goodnow, you may note that somebody decided it was a good time for a concert upstairs, so speak.
Mr. Chairman, it's always nice to have background music.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Goodnow, I am the president of the board of the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. I'm also a father of a 12-year-old with epilepsy. And it's an honor to be here today to just talk to you about why the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota supports this bill and talk about the importance of this. I'll also be followed by Lori Ullman, who is somebody with epilepsy that's faced this issue of substitution and had negative impacts, and Dr. Frost, who is a neurologist on these issues. So the bill itself, the purpose of the bill is really to empower the patient to be the center of the decision-making process with regard to what kind of medicines that they're taking for their seizures and for seizure control. The epilepsy itself is a generic label that is a label of a number of different seizure disorders that are out there. So when people talk about epilepsy, it could mean a different type of seizure for one person versus another. Probably the most common that people associate with epilepsy are the grand mal, full convulsive type of seizures that people will see. Epilepsy itself will impact about 1 in 10 people in this country will either have or have had a seizure in their lifetime, 1 in 10. So about 10% of the people will be impacted by epilepsy or seizures. And the thing about seizures, when my daughter was diagnosed back in 2005, the doctor that diagnosed her said, you know, there's a 50%, after her first seizure, there's a 50% chance she'll never have another one. So she's my oldest kid. We thought, hey, perfect, you know, she's a perfect kid. That was just a fluke. It won't happen again. Well, 2 months later, when she had her second seizure, the doctor said there's an 80% chance she'll have another one. So when it comes to dealing with seizure disorders, what you want to do is you want to get seizure control as quickly as possible, because the more seizures a person has, the more seizures they're going to have. And the more seizures they have, the harder it is to get control of those seizures. So the key is to gain control as quickly as possible, because it's easier to control at that time. Once you gain control, you don't want to lose control, because there's evidence out there that once you've lost seizure control, that and you've had a breakthrough seizure, it takes a number of years for people to regain control, and in about 25% of that group of people, they never do regain control again. It's not like high blood pressure medicine where you can go back on the medicine again. Once you lose it, it's really hard to control it. So the consequences of the seizure, and people die from seizures. They die from seizures. We've had a number of people since I've been president die from seizures that we're aware of. It's usually related to other issues, breaking your neck in a full convulsive seizure, and other types of and other things that can happen. So this is very serious when you have a breakthrough seizure, and the consequences to an individual are very great. Now, we'll hear, and a number of people believe that the small variations in the concentration of anti-epileptic medicines or anti-epileptic drugs, either generic or branded, can cause toxic effects and seizures with epilepsy. When we get control, folks, my daughter was very fortunate. We were able to control her seizures with one medicine rather quickly. But about 25% of the people really have a hard time gaining seizure control. And a lot of times it's a combination of different medicines that are needed in order to get that seizure control. And when folks test bioequivalents, what they don't test is the bioequivalents on people with seizures. They test it on healthy people. And they don't test the interaction among the various drugs as well. And there are definitely people that deal with folks with epilepsy as part of their living, as part of their practice, feel there are real concerns here. And I want to make note that there's in your packet a letter from the Mayo Clinic doctors. There's 8 neurologists that deal with people with epilepsy on a regular basis to support this legislation. We also have a letter of support from the American Academy of Neurologists as well. With that, I just wanted to talk about what the bill is not. Senator Higgins mentioned what the bill does. It basically is, if a person with epilepsy is on an anti-seizure medicine and has been on it for 60 days or more, so they're under a course of treatment with the medicine, that if the pharmacist switches either from a brand to a generic, from one manufacturer to generic to another manufacturer's generic, that before they do the switch, they have to get the patient's permission. and then notify the doctor within 10 days. This is all about focusing the emphasis on the patient, putting them in control of the medical decisions that are going on and will impact their lives. What it does not do, and quite frankly, we don't really care about, we don't want to get in the middle of the debate between generics versus branded about market share. That's not our concern. What we want to know is we get cost-effective medicines and that they're effective and give the person the choice about what medicines they're taking. The other thing it doesn't do, it doesn't affect coverage. We're not talking about saying that that somebody has to pay for this. We're just saying that the person, the patient needs to be, know that the switch is going to take place. That patient can then decide if they want to pay more to stay on the branded, if it's not on the formulary, or go to the generic and work with their physician to make sure they monitor it to make sure they don't have that breakthrough seizure. That's it for the support, and I really appreciate your support for this legislation that would empower people with epilepsy to be in control of their medical decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. Ms. Ullman.
I'm Lori Ullman. I have been diagnosed with epilepsy for 30-plus years. I am currently on a generic form of Zonegran and have been on that generic form for roughly 8 years. I have been seizure-free for 7. About 14 years ago, 15 years ago, I was on a generic form of Tegretol, and somewhere along me taking that medication, I started having cluster seizures out of nowhere. My 6-year-old son got to see me have a full-blown grand mal, had to dial 911 and sit with me while the paramedics came. The doctors thought that the Tegretol just quit working, so they started me searching for another drug to put me on. Tegretol had been working since 1989, and this was 1994. I had been seizure-free. 6 months later, after they started putting me on other medications, they found out that my generic form had been switched from one maker to another, which had dropped my levels to a certain point, and that's why my cluster seizures started. But I was never notified. My doctor was never notified. And so if I had been notified, you know, that I was being switched from one maker to another, I would have been able to tell my doctor it could be, you know, the brand of medication instead of my seizures or my medication not working anymore and having to go through a year and a half, almost 2 years, of going through medication after medication after medication, having to take a leave of absence from my work, losing pay, losing my health insurance for my family. I was a sole provider of health insurance for my family at that time. They didn't have transportation for people with epilepsy because at that time it was not considered a disability. So it was very tragic, very chaotic, and it just awful at that time. I want to know what I'm putting in my body. I want to have control of my health care. I've had control of my health care for the last 20 years, and it's what keeps me seizure-free. I make the decisions on my health care, and I want to continue to be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ullman. Go ahead, sir.
Dr. Hey, Mr. Chairman, I'm Dr. Michael Frost. I'm a pediatrician, pediatric neurologist specializing in epilepsy. I'm the medical director of the pediatric inpatient epilepsy unit at Children's here in St. Paul. When I see a new diagnosis of epilepsy or a new patient or start a different medication, I caution families and patients that if there's any change made, please let us know. We prefer that they stick to one pill appearance, if they would, particularly once somebody gets under control. Roughly a third of patients don't come under control. And when they do break through, it can have significant consequences. The families as well as the patients don't really have that option sometimes. When we look at overall medications, even TV commercials tell people that are watching about new medications, please inform your physician when something's changed and make sure that they know what other medicines maybe interacting with what you're now asking them to prescribe. When we don't know that there's been a change, by definition, again, the difference amongst generics and amongst the brand name, by definition from the FDA, it can be considerable, particularly when it's being switched from one to another. Again, this is not about which is best. This is just about being able to check levels, being able to make sure that if there is a change in the way the pill looks, the person realizes that it's a different medication. If they ask, I mean, I asked a pharmacist when I got a prescription filled recently, they said, well, we're changing the generic manufacturer. I said, oh, so it's a little bit different. And the tech said, oh, absolutely not. It's the same as always. Well, that's by definition not correct. So when if we don't know when changes are made and there's an increase in seizures, we can do a lot of unnecessary testing, a lot of unnecessary medication changes, as you've already heard. If it's an adult or someone who has a driver's license, they can't drive in this state for 6 months after they've had a breakthrough. That can have a significant impact on their lifestyle, on their business, on everything, okay? From the point of view of even interactions, the more medications, it has been stated, when the FDA asks the companies to check medications for generic versus brand, it has to be at a certain percentage of the original, but they don't do it with other medications on board. They don't test for interactions. They don't worry about absorption. The patients themselves, the test subjects, are not really patients. So when you take it's a house of cards in some patients and families, and if we don't know when changes are made, we have no way of reacting to it or anticipating potential problems.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, in a case like Ms. Ullman's case, I think she started with a generic. I think she said, how many people start with a particular generic? And, I picture pharmacies changing drugs all the time. Is in some fields, is that the case? But like in epilepsy, is it traditionally been more stable? Because Ms. Ullman, you had it for several years. You were on the same one.
Yes.
Many years. And yours was a generic, the original one.
Yes.
And then they changed brands after?
After probably 4 or 5 years. Well, I was on it from 1989 to 1994. So, and then in 1994 is when they changed from one maker to another.
As far as, you know, I think a lot of that depends on the family situation and their coverage. You know, even if we write, dispense as written, it doesn't always happen. And we also, and the realistic aspect of things, copays can be 10 times for a brand name that they are for a generic. So, again, this is not about generic versus brand name at all, okay, because we understand what, you know, the real world and what costs things. All we want to know is when they change manufacturer, whether it's generic or amongst the different,
I hear you.
You know, the brand names or whatever, that we know about it so that we can do appropriate testing.
So when you write dispenses written for a generic drug,
only money.
How do you write dispenses written for this brand of generic drug?
Well, you can write the manufacturer if you want. Okay, if you know.
If you know.
Right. We do ask the families or the patients to let us know if the pills change in their appearance. So at least we have some idea if there's been a change.
Senator Johnson and Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins, I support your bill, but I have a couple questions. At the pharmacy, is there a file or is there a flag on the patient that says epileptic?
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Is there a flag at the pharmacy that informs the pharmacist? I guess I should ask my first question. This actually applies to other types of patients. It applies, sounds like, to anybody that gets anti-seizure medicine.
Correct.
Is that correct? So now the pharmacist is going to have to keep track of, is he going to have some kind of notification that he's to be more diligent?
Mr. Chairman, the majority of the medications we use, okay, are only used for epilepsy. And we only have about 10 to 15 different medications that we use that are available in this country. I mean, more so in recent years, but there's a limited number. It's not, you know, antihypertensives. It's not antibiotics. It's not any of those. And once somebody's on it, they're on it indefinitely. So, yes, I mean, they would know. A pharmacist would know, for example, that levetiracetam, Keppra, is being used in this patient because of epilepsy.
Mr. Chair, and so this is going to take a little bit of a re-education piece for the pharmacist.
And ask the pharmacist to be partners with us.
True. What is our expectation of that? How are you going to accomplish that?
Mr. Chairman, number one, they need to inform the patient, okay, so that the patient can ask the physician. Number two, they fax us and email us and all sorts of things when they need refills. Okay, so they do communicate or have the patient communicate with our offices whenever there's a new prescription or they run out of refills or whatever. So it would just be a matter of doing the same thing.
Mr. Chair, and former commissioner, you might be able to answer my question. As supportive as I am of this, this is going to be a bit problematic. How are you going to have this work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, to me, a simple way would be to identify the medication, and that there are certain medications that are prescribed for anticonvulsives or anti-seizures medications, and that would be the flag that you'd be looking at is when those medications came up for a prescription, that's when you would take that step and make the notification. And if you're informed by the patient that, hey, it's not being prescribed for this reason, then you don't need to make the notification. But I would, you know, would guess they would err on the side of having those flags in for those medications. Additionally, the Board of Pharmacy would come up with those I would assume if there's any problematic regulations about that, they would work on the next step on how to make sure that that works.
Mr. Chair, and is there any consequence to, I mean, I don't want you guys to have a problem, you know. Is there, if this happens, and it may, is there a consequence in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, my assumption would be that if this were a course of action, if it's a mistake once in a while, I think the Board of Pharmacy would be looking at are the pharmacists following the requirements of practicing pharmacy in the state of Minnesota. And if there's if they do an investigation and there was problems with it, and I would assume it'd be more than just one situation, that they would work with them to make sure they educate them and correct them with regard to that issue. And if they fail to comply with the law at that point, then there may be other consequences after that. And I see Mr. Weiberg is actually in the audience and probably could answer that a whole lot better than I could.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I think also the prescribing physician would be talking to the patients and saying, you know, there's been a change in the law, and, you know, would you please, when you get your prescriptions, look to see that they are the same and now something can be done so that they aren't just being swapped out on a regular basis. So I think it's not only the pharmacist, but it's the physician and the patient who are kind of all have to work it out. But I think it can be doable.
Senator Erickson-Oakes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Higgins. I think you have a really good bill here, and I support it. My question is, however, if this, we've heard testimony at this committee and others in the past that the same problem is happening with patients who are dealing with bipolar disorder and a lot of other illnesses, that if they have their medications changed, even from a named drug to generic, sometimes that gives very different outcomes for patients. Why are we just limiting it to anti-epileptic medications? Why should not every patient who is the recipient of a change between the doctor's pen and whatever they put in their mouth, why isn't every patient notified that the pharmacist or pharmacy or someone else in between has made a substitution?
I can do it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, I can speak from the position of the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, and that we were aware of similar legislation that was out there. We were aware of legislation that was specifically targeted to anti-epileptic drugs a couple of years ago. We basically took a really close look at that and said, you know, this really doesn't address the issue that we've identified with the people that we deal with that are suffering from epilepsy. And that's why we worked with the medication, with the legislation. We worked with the people in Minnesota that we work with, our members and the people that we support who have epilepsy, to identify legislation that will address their needs. We don't feel qualified to address those other areas that go beyond the issue of seizure control. This is where we're comfortable, and quite frankly, we asked Senator Higgins to carry this legislation, so I'm assuming that's why it's focused this way.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Goodnow, thank you. I do understand the slice of the pie that you're dealing with here, just with the epileptic community, and I will support this bill, but I also think your bill is relevant to people who are getting any other kind of medications, who get their meds switched between, again, when the doctor prescribes them, or if they're changed, again, from the name prescription to generic, or from one generic variety, as you're talking about here, one manufacturer of a generic to another manufacturer, because for some people, not everyone, but for many people, it does make a difference on a very chemical, molecular level in them. And again, unless we want patients turning around and having side effects or events that had been controlled that aren't controlled anymore, and then having the doctor go through lots of testing to figure out what's going on, it seems to me to be a very smart and common sense approach to prescription filling.
Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson-Robes, I think that over the years we have gotten more aware of what's being prescribed, medications we're taking and how they're different, from manufacturer to manufacturer, generic and others. I always think of my mom, who was born in 1915, and whatever the doctor told her was always right, whatever that was. Mm-hmm. And she didn't particularly want to know the details, mm-hmm. But it was, I take it in the morning and I take it at supper. Whatever it is, that's what I do because that's what it says. And I think now that we all have access to so much more information about prescriptions and healthcare in general, that we all are feeling that we need to take more control of our own healthcare. And so I agree with you. I'm not going to tackle
Senator
that.
Senator Higgins, I'm going to try and speed this up, though, because we've got so many other bills. Senator Dow, and then we have some witnesses who have opposition to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that we bring this forward because we're the concern over maybe some adverse reactions to switches in medication. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Chair, and then so my understanding is that right now I want to keep this the program simple as possible so we eliminate confusion. But why isn't it as I'm looking at some of this written literature that the doctor can write dispenses written that's not good enough for addressing this problem?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, the dispenses written issue is separate and distinct from this one. So they don't overlap. There's dispenses written is when the physician themselves is prescribing a certain medication and they want that medication prescribed. And they write dispenses written on that. And the pharmacist is supposed to follow that that designation. What this is, in a situation where the doctor doesn't write dispenses written, or if they don't get that message out to the pharmacist when they renew the prescription maybe a year later, something breaks down, that let's just say, for example, we take Keppra, which is an anti-seizure medicine that also has a generic out, that if the doctor prescribes Keppra but doesn't do DAW on it, that they can take that to the pharmacist and the pharmacist can substitute the generic right there. And we don't care about that. We're fine with that. Because we want to have the lowest cost options for the people with epilepsy out there as well. But what we aren't fine with is that once they start on that course of treatment with that generic and have been on that course of treatment for 60 days, we don't want the pharmacist switching that medication to another manufacturer's generic or to the branded drug without notifying and getting the permission of the patient. So it's more of once they're on the course of treatment, we don't want that to happen without notifying the patient getting the permission.
Mr. Chair, and then Mr. Goodnow, then on this this issue, if you've got a new, you go to a different pharmacist, this reason has reason to know. How would they, I mean, how would they know if you switched pharmacies?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, reason to know is a, you know, art of, term of art with regard to the legal profession, and that's that if you have reason to know. If you, if you're going to a if you see the first person for the, if you're a corner pharmacist, you've never seen the person before, the person doesn't tell you that he's, that they're having any type of certain types of medicine before, you don't have reason to know and you don't know. If you go to a chain drugstore regularly and you go to a different chain drugstore of the same chain and they have an integrated system where they should be able to track this information, they would have reason to know if they actually track that kind of that kind of information. So that was actually put in there as comfort language for the pharmacist, that they, that it's not a, just a black and white, that they had to notify everybody all the time. I would assume that one way that the pharmacist could address this is that for all anti-seizure medicines, that they would just have this, this as a standard practice.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Goodnow, I'm trying to think there's, if there's some issue about liability on me, and we're opening this up to the pharmacists now, they're putting some responsibility on them to sort of be the checks and balances here. And if we're saying, well, they've got to get consent, but we don't, it's not really clear if it's a verbal consent or a written consent. I mean, how do we prove that if there's an adverse reaction? What is, what does consent mean? And it, and then as far as reason to know, is it that's, again, simply because we need to have some protection against a possible adverse reaction and the pharmacist would now be liable for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, the consent issue is, I'm assuming it would be similar to what they do right now when you ask, when they ask if you want to have a, when you sign for the medication, that that would be part of the consent process that they could go through at this point, at that point. So I think that's not, if that, that that's an issue, I think that can be easily addressed.
Okay.
With regard to the liability issue, they're liable for the drugs and for acting in a professional manner. They're healthcare professionals. And as healthcare professionals who are dispensing product that can either help people or harm people, they have a certain level of responsibility to the patients that they're serving. And part of that responsibility by enacting this law is to actually ask the patient when they do a switch on an anti-seizure medicine that it's okay with the patient. As part of being the health, the broader healthcare system, and then also notifying the prescribing doctor, the doctor who's in charge of the care for that patient, that they're actually making that change. So it, it's part of the system. As far as the liability goes, I saw that in one of the handouts that I saw that we greatly expanded. I don't know what the basis for that greatly expanded liability is. I can't figure it out.
Sarah Hand, and then the opposition witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Frost, just clarify for me, the part of the testimony here is the rationale for the law is to deal with adverse reactions when medications are changed. My question is, do patients have changes in their seizure behavior without a change in medication? Does that happen?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I mean, it can happen, but once they've come under control, they stabilize. And during the, you know, it takes a while to get some people under control. For many, you know, up to 50%, you can control them on the first medication you try. And then about 30%, you'll never control.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Frost, I just want to clarify. So once a person is on a course of medication to control seizures, there aren't breakthroughs without change in medication? Is that your testimony, that the breakthrough seizures only occur when there's a change in medication?
Not only. I mean, when somebody gets ill, I mean, there are other reasons why somebody may have breakthroughs. A combination of a new medication, for example, an interaction, a missed dose. I mean, there are many reasons why someone may have a breakthrough.
But, and Mr. Chairman and Dr. Frost, I'm not sure if you can, I guess what I'm trying to isolate, we have a remedy here that is presuming the cause is a change in medication, and I'm just trying to understand, are we certain that is the cause of the things that you're concerned about, or there, could there be other reasons for those things to occur?
Well, that's usually the simplest explanation, okay, and we stop looking for other causes, particularly if with the change in medication, the level has changed or the interaction with medicine has changed. So, yes, it would be the most common in a situation where someone's been controlled. And I should add, Mr. Chairman, that I don't write DAW anymore. When patients tell me that the brand name costs them $300 copay and the generic will cost them $10 copay. I mean, I can't force individuals to pay that kind of differential.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's start with the opposition witnesses as quickly as we can. We have a long agenda. We're not getting as far as I had hoped we would by now. Mr. Lott, Mr. Root, Mr. Dr. Strawn. Go ahead, whoever wants to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Dr. Arthur Strawn. I am a professor emeritus from the University of Tennessee College of Pharmacy. I'm the director of the drug research laboratory there. I've been involved in drug research directly related to this issue that you've been talking about for the last 35 years. I have had numerous contracts with the Food and Drug Administration to conduct clinical trials to address the very issues that you're trying to address today. The trials that I've been conducting over the years have resulted in the regulatory aspect of generic drugs as promulgated by the Code of Federal Regulations to assure that the drug supply of generics in this country are safe and effective. I'd like to only spend a couple of minutes. I've got a semester's worth of material to give to you, but I will try to move it down to 5 minutes. All right? Now, the first thing I think that you need to understand as it relates to generic drugs are that a generic drug and a brand drug are exactly the same drug. The formulation, it could be potentially a little bit different with the excipients that are in there, but a generic drug has to be a tablet substituted for a tablet of exactly the same milligram content. Now, from the standpoint of compendial regulations in making a drug formulation, all drugs, at least for the most part, I can't say for every single drug, but the content uniformity of the pills that you get in that bottle have to be, according to the United States Pharmacopeia, all of them have to be within plus or minus 10% of what they say is in the bottle. So if you have a bottle that says this is a 100 milligram tablet, you can have a 90 milligram tablet in there, or you could have a 110 milligram tablet in there. It's a 20% difference that is allowed by compendial regulations. Now, that's theoretical. If you truly apply the statistic that has to go into how this value is used, you're only going to find a 2 or maybe even as much as a 3% difference in terms of the value of the content in there. Now, that means if you really look at it broadly from a theoretical standpoint, one lot of brand could be as much as 10% lower than the next lot of the brand, or 10% higher, or a 20% different from one lot to the next of a brand drug. Well, obviously that is not going to be the case from a manufacturing process, because as I said before, the statistic says plus or minus 10%, but the reality is only 2 or maybe even 3%. The FDA, when they came up with the regulations for what does it mean for a generic drug to be equivalent to a brand product, they had in mind at that point in time that not only were the brand and generic going to be substituted for each other, but generics versus generics would also be substituted. So when they made the regulations related to testing these drugs, which generics have to be tested in patients, they set up a regulation that on the surface sounds like a very large variability to be allowed for the generic to the brand. Some of you may have heard this, that, you know, the generic can be as much as 20% below or 25% above the brand product. In other words, this is called the 80 to 125 rule. Well, that again is a theoretical value. From the standpoint of applying the statistic that goes into that theoretical value, you can only have, and I've never seen it because I've done hundreds and hundreds of these trials in patients, if you have more than a 10% mean difference, you're not going to pass this 20% criteria that they talk about. Right? In reality, the FDA has done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comparisons of the studies that have been sent to them, and on average, the difference between a brand and a generic is less than 5% on all of the drugs that they have an opportunity to evaluate. And the actual difference is somewhere around 3% for one parameter and maybe 4% for another. But there's very, very little difference. What does this mean from the standpoint of where you're getting at? I've heard the previous people testifying that I don't have any problem with a generic drug. They're fine. But what I do have a problem with is switching one generic with another. Well, if you look at what the statistics show you and what the data that's available for evaluation, there shouldn't be any concern. I don't see how there could be more than a 10% difference in switching from one to another. Now, you also have heard from previous testimony that the generic drug, as though this generic drug is a different chemical, it's not. It's the exact same molecule. This generic drug has not been tested in patients, so we don't know how that's going to react in the bloodstream. Well, that's not exactly right. We have done in our laboratories over and over again, not over and over, but in several studies in which we studied the bioavailability of the drug, the generic and the brand drug, in normal subjects, and then did a parallel study in patients. Now, guess what we found? We actually found that the patients had different bioavailability than the subjects, but the bioequivalence, the actual bioequivalence in terms of the percent difference between the brand and the generic, was identical. So the patients had higher blood levels, but they also had higher blood levels for both the brand and the generic. So there was equivalency in terms of what was going on. Also, there seems to be some concern about, well, there's other drugs that are being given that could interact with the generic product that don't interact with the brand product or vice versa. Well, pharmacokinetic drug interactions occur within the bloodstream. And once the drug gets into the bloodstream, the body isn't going to know which drug is from a generic and which is from a brand. Drug interactions and so forth are the same. Now, finally, if I could just make one...
Very quickly, sir, because you're eating up the other people's time.
Okay.
We've got three other people.
Final comment.
Thank you.
Final comment. This issue is going to be resolved by the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration this coming year, in that they have sponsored a large multi-center clinical trial on antiepileptic drug to evaluate switches in patients between brands and generics. So I might urge you to rethink your vote at this point in time and wait till a real answer comes forth. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Strawn. Who's next? Go ahead.
I'll go next. Vernon Rowan. I'm Vice President of State Affairs for Express Scripts, a pharmacy benefit manager that manages the pharmacy benefit for about 50 million Americans across the country. we are hired by clients to manage their prescription drug benefit, and we look at issues like this very closely. And our company actually looked very specifically at this issue of whether there was a causal relationship between people being switched from different versions of generic drugs or from brand to generic drugs and their having a breakout seizure or other seizure events. There have been studies on this. We've seen studies that have suggested there is a relationship. We've looked at those studies. They included groups of 50 people in one study, 8 cases in another study, and there were not control groups with those. We have a pretty robust database that we looked through of about 50 million Americans. We identified about 34,000 potential patients who could be evaluated for whether there is a relationship here. And we ended up looking at about 3,000 patients with about an 8,000 patient control group. We looked at this very carefully. Let me say this. We looked at this in an agnostic fashion. If there was indeed a problem with these type of switches, we wanted to make sure that we were recommending to our clients that those switches not take place. Our first rule is that what we do clinically is going to be in the best interest of the patient and result in the best outcome. Now, having said that, we also work to make sure that once we've established that we're getting the best value for the dollars that our clients are paying. So we looked at this agnostically. If we found that there was going to be a clinical problem with this, the recommendation to our clients was going to be that there not be these switches. On the other hand, if we found that there was no evidence, or at least no evidence that there was a causal relationship here, our recommendation to our clients would be that they not change their current benefit plan and they not change their behavior in terms of encouraging the switch to generics. We conducted this study, 3,000 patients. We did not find any reason to make a different recommendation to our clients. The recommendation we continue to make to our clients is that we follow the FDA guidance, that these drugs are interchangeable, that there is not a significant difference in these drugs. Let me point out a fact that they maybe didn't quite come out in the doctor's testimony. We recognize there is a variance between the brand and the generic, and there's a recognized level of variance that the FDA has said is safe. There's also that same level of variance from batch to batch in the same brand name drug. So if I'm a patient, I'm on a brand name anti-seizure drug, and I go to the pharmacy each month to get my supply of medication, same drug, same brand, I could well experience the same variance in effectiveness in that same brand as I would as if they gave me a generic. It's the same level of variance. I don't want to diminish the concerns that have been brought here by the patient advocates today. Those are horrible stories. And if I had a family member involved in this, I would feel awful about it. I'd want to get down. I'd want to find out what the problem is and what's causing it. I would offer, based on what we've looked at as a company and doing a fairly exhaustive look at our database and being objective about it, we don't see a relationship here. We just don't see a relationship. And I would ask you to really, there are always going to be anecdotes. There are always going to be bad stories that come up. And these things happen. They're real. But we've got to manage this healthcare system based on science, not on anecdote. And this is an important issue. There's a lot of money involved in terms of healthcare resources. And the more healthcare resources we can save by continuing to use generics, that money can be used for other areas of the healthcare system. We feel like we have an obligation to do that as long as safety is not being jeopardized. Let me just make a couple of other points. There was a suggestion that when a physician writes dispense as written on a script, that that's not followed at the pharmacy. That's against the law. And if a pharmacy is doing that, someone should be bringing charges. That is against the law. The law in this state says if I write dispense as written, that's what has to be filled at the pharmacy. If that's not what's happening at the pharmacy, we've got a different problem that we need to talk about today. In summation, let me say this. There are other ways to deal with this problem. For example, talking with the physician community that treats these patients to make absolutely sure that they're writing dispenses written on the script if they are concerned about that patient and that they might break out into seizures again if that changes. And making sure that the physician continues to talk to the patient. We're putting an obligation on pharmacists here to basically track and monitor this now. And let's be honest. That patient is going back and seeing the same doctor on a regular basis. They're not necessarily going back and seeing the same pharmacist on a regular basis. I know when I fill prescriptions, I fill them in two or three different pharmacies based on what's most convenient for me that day. You're going to ask Pharmacy A to find out what Pharmacy B filled 60 days ago or within 60 days and potentially hold them accountable if they don't make the notification to these patients. I think you're causing a lot of unintended consequences. They don't necessarily fix the problem. They may create more problems. And the truth is there's an effective way to deal with this without enacting this legislation.
Thank you. Next witness.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I promise I'll be very brief. My name is Bruce Lott, and I'm the Director of State Government Relations from Mylan. Mylan is one of the world's leading generic pharmaceutical manufacturers, and we are the largest U.S.-based manufacturer of generic drugs. We respectfully oppose this legislation. We believe this legislation will increase the cost of health care for the state through Medicaid, public employees programs, and also increase the cost of health care for consumers and payers. More than 70% of the prescriptions used to treat epilepsy in Minnesota's Medicaid program are filled with generics, according to the latest information we've been able to obtain from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Even a 1% reduction in generic utilization of antiepileptics would cost the state as much as $1 million a year. We urge the committee to consider the cost of Medicaid and the health care system before making a decision on this issue. I'd also like to point out one other issue that may be of value to you here, since the sponsors are obviously interested in ensuring that patients know which the manufacturer they're receiving a drug from. My understanding is that under current Minnesota law, when a patient fills a prescription, it has the name of the manufacturer on the bottle that is filled with. So you can look from one filling of a prescription to the next, and you will see if there has been a change in the manufacturer right there on the bottle, as well as in the paperwork that is provided along with it. So for those physicians and patients who have this concern, they already have the information at their disposal under current Minnesota law. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wished to testify? I know there are three others who had signed up, Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, could I have a question of these, the Express Scripts, Mr. Rowan? Thank you for testimony. I'm curious, with anti-epileptic drugs how many do you actually carry in your formulary between the brands and the generics?
I can get you the specific answer on that class of drug, but generally we try to make at least three or four different drugs available on the formulary, recognizing that while they may all be equally effective, physicians need to have some choice and some latitude in terms of what they prescribe for a specific patient.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chair, and just to follow up then, so even though they're equally effective, do you ever make a change versus what the doctor has prescribed based solely on cost?
We don't. What we do is we evaluate the clinical effectiveness of all the drugs in a class of drugs. We'll make a recommendation of a handful of those that are the most effective. We then go out based on that and get the best price that we can. Once we've figured out which the best ones are, we create competition and get the best price. But at the end of the day, the physician decides which drug is prescribed to that patient. We don't switch it. We can't switch it. Recommendations can be made based on what the patient's benefits plan is, but ultimately the physician decides which drug is prescribed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, go ahead.
Senator Marty, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Julie Johnson. I am the Executive Vice President for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Representing the practicing pharmacists in the state, I have with me Buzz Anderson, representing the Minnesota retailers. I'm here to speak in opposition, respectful opposition, of Senate File 1137. You have a handout in front of you that we supplied in the past, and I will try to be brief and answer your questions based on all of what I heard today up until now. Pharmacists believe that current policy that allows generic substitution is just very much justified by the FDA process that we hang our hats on. And I think it was Mr. Goodnow earlier that said we are responsible for all of them. Yes, we are. We hang our hat on the fact that there is an FDA process that assures pharmacists that drug A that's generically and therapeutically equivalent to drug B are the same and they are interchangeable. That's the policy under which we operate and we hang our hats on. We believe that this bill takes a swipe at that unnecessarily. Having listened to the rest of the discussion today, do I believe there are other ways we can help those unfortunate patients who have that trouble today? Yes, I do. And I think that there were several suggestions, one of which the physician who testified talked about talking with pharmacists more. It would be great if we knew diagnosis, but we don't know that. We don't have that information readily available to us. We believe that DAW is a valid process. It is used. It is very much adhered to. It has to be. It's law. And we are audited to make sure it is adhered to. So that is a valid process. And any place in the prescription process where a patient wants a DAW, whether we ask them, the patient asks him, the physician decides, he can make that happen, not just at the beginning, anywhere in the process. That is available. I think that this sets up the bill as it sits today, sets up complications that are unworkable and unjustifiable. I believe that there are opportunities in place right now that were talked about earlier where we can do a better job of giving patients information and engaging them more, having them talk to us each time or maybe read the label a little more carefully in some cases. We can work on those things, but this bill absolutely, we don't believe, is justified at this time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sirhan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Johnson, this dispense has written process. Can a physician write a prescription for a generic formula by a particular manufacturer and make that a DAW prescription? In other words, there's a brand of the particular medication and there's a generic, and there may be many manufacturers. Can a physician require a certain manufactured generic brand be a dispense as written prescription?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to Senator Hand, yes.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Johnson, under what circumstances would then, in this particular legislation, says you'd have a substitute, how would that work I'm assuming if there isn't a DAW, then is it the health plan telling the pharmacy that they need to make the switch to a generic brand or switch from one brand to another? How does that occur?
Senator Dahl, it occurs many ways. In this state, we are allowed to dispense a generic if one is available. Oftentimes, it's required by the plan, yes. When there is a DAW, obviously, we honor that. When the patient has a concern and wants the red ones because they got the red ones that in a previous refill, we do our best to get the red ones. The other unworkable part of this legislation would be that pharmacies don't get to choose oftentimes to switch generics. Their suppliers, their wholesalers have contracts for a period of time with a generic manufacturer that supplies the generics to the wholesaler, which supplies them to the pharmacy. In some cases, we may ask to get a generic that is not available because the patient came to our pharmacy, maybe was at a different pharmacy who uses a different wholesaler. Not that we wouldn't try, but it's sometimes not possible. And then also, if the patient is on a specific insurance plan I think I made my point.
And one last question, if I could, Mr. Chair, Ms. Johnson. If you get a DAW, is it only for that one prescription, or do you put it on file for that patient that this is DAW for, that original prescription, so that you can see that if it comes up again, even though if it isn't on that specific prescription that you got a refill, that you have it on file?
Yes, sir, Senator Dahl. It electronically, it's and in paper copy, we have both. So it is valid for each fill of that prescription. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Anderson, very briefly.
Mr. Chair, members, I will be brief. Buzz Anderson with the Minnesota Retailers Association. Dr. Johnson and I share many of the same members. We jointly chair the Community Pharmacy Committee, where we discuss many of these matters. She and I discussed my testimony, and she has summarized my comments in her testimony. So I have nothing other to say other than to say that we do oppose the legislation, again, respectfully, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, once again, to be clear, this bill does not say that the prescription cannot be substituted. It just requires that the patient be involved in the decision and that the prescribing physician know about the substitution. And I think we've had lots of testimony. At this time, I'll move the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins moves Senate File 1137. And that the bill be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Berglund.
Yes, I believe there may be a fiscal note on this bill, and so I would request it be sent to Finance to find
out. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Before we move the bill, I had gotten some information from the Board of Pharmacy about this issue. I'm wondering if there's anybody from the Board of Pharmacy that would be interested in giving us some testimony on this before we move the bill.
Mr. Weaver, could you do a 1 or minute type of thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. If I understood the question, did I care to testify? I was actually hoping to wait to finance when the fiscal note kind of took care of it. Basically, the Board of Pharmacy did something that's very unusual for it. Previous versions of this bill were introduced in late 2007, early 2008. I always bring this sort of information to the Board. My normal recommendation to them, since we are primarily concerned with public safety, is to really avoid taking sides on issues like this. However, the Board members were quite adamant to oppose this legislation for a variety of reasons. First of all, and I think the most salient point that was mentioned during all this testimony was from the gentleman from Express Scripts who introduced himself, but whose name I've already forgotten, unfortunately. Here's the bottom line. According to the FDA, unless the FDA is incorrect, the risk of developing breakthrough seizures because of a difference in the potency of a drug, if you will, is the same if you switch from one lot of the brand name to the second lot of the brand name as it is if you switch from a lot of the brand name to a lot of the generic. That gentleman mentioned that the variability is the same. So if the variability can occur, it's not going to just be between two different generic versions or between the brand and generic versions. It's going to be between two lots of the same brand name drug that are coming off the same line, if it's going to occur. However, that is exceedingly rare for that to happen in any case. So that's one reason. The science just isn't there. The other reason is we are somewhat worried about what may happen because, as my former boss, former Commissioner Goodnow, points out, this doesn't have an impact or this does not require payers to pay for the brand name drug. So what's going to happen in pharmacies is people are going to come in, they're going to want the brand name drug, and if the pharmacist can't actually convince the patient that there's really no need to do that, and the insurance company doesn't pay for it, the pharmacy is going to spend time trying to get a prior authorization to get the brand name drug paid for, which can actually delay therapy, depending on how insistent the patient is on getting the brand name drug. The other thing that I think was an important point that was brought up is the Food and Drug Administration is studying this issue in the federal appropriation bill for the Food and Drug Administration was passed last fall. Congress directed the FDA to study this issue and report back to them by the end of September of this year. So I think we're going to have a lot more data on which to make this. assessment. Now, taking off my hat as the Board of Pharmacy Executive Director, some of the committee members may remember that prior to moving over to the board, I was the Pharmacy Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And that gets back to my original comment and back to Senator Berglund's point. There will be a fiscal note on this. And to answer, actually to make an observation about what Senator Erickson Ropes questioned, why don't we do this for all drugs? If we did that for all drugs, the fiscal note just from Department of Human Services alone would be, unless something has changed, would be in the tens of millions of dollars. There's that much at stake in terms of the fiscal note on this. And basically that's really all I've got. I'll answer any questions there might be.
Questions? Senator Higgins.
Move the bill ready.
Senator Higgins has moved the bill. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you all very much.
Senator Dibble, we've heard this bill in joint committee, or I think it was in joint committee. We will be as quick as we can on this. We're going to ask you and your witnesses to be like 5 minutes, and opposition maybe like 5 minutes as well, 7 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I could be briefer if you so desire, and if that helps me move this bill on to its next stop, which I believe, Mr. Chair, is Commerce. But Mr. Chair, first I'd like to mention members and Mr. Chair. This is Senate File 2242, and this has to do with foreclosures and creating a period of 2 years, we can hold on given foreclosure and allow folks to kind of get their feet back under them and work things out and responds to what we've observed in the foreclosure crisis of late. It responds to some of the inadequacy of some of the measures that we have passed in recent years. It seems like foreclosures are still continuing at a pace unabated, increasing, and tells us that perhaps some other more significant measures need to be taken. With that, Mr. Chair, we did have the hearing during the interim, and some critique was offered at that point, and that's reflected in an A2 amendment. I don't know if that's at committee members' places. Okay, it's in your packets. So if someone would do me the courtesy of moving the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, so moved. Senator Dow moves the A2 amendment.
Can I just ask, is this the last bill we're going to hear today? Because there's at least, four more on here. And I noticed Senator Kielash is sitting there at the end of the table, and I wasn't sure if he was actually going to.
And Senator Higgins was just asking about that as well. And what I was hoping to do was have a brief presentation on those four bills, but we're running out of time. I know some of the advocates would like to. I know that there are a lot of people who came for those. I don't know if we'll have time to have a vote on them today. I think if we can, let's give this 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes on each side, and then see if we can have, I guess all we're going to have then is presentation of the two bills, of the four bills that we have left, right?
So, Mr. Chair, we will not be voting because obviously, schedule-wise and what time we're scheduled until, and we make other appointments and, lots going on. And so if we are going to attempt to hear everything that's on here, I would like to know for certain that we would not be, if I have to leave, that we would not be voting or moving any bills.
And we can, I was told with this bill, we can give it more time in Commerce because I know that's where most of these issues are going to be. Why don't we try this for, I will commit to not going more than 3:10 for ending because I know others have committees. I think some of these chairs are committee as well.
And what time is this committee scheduled to end?
We've been doing three.
Two? Okay, I just wanted to check because
yeah, no,
I was because I
after.
Schedule things for
it's
three,
at 3:10, yes.
And so now we're going to 3:10. So it is. I mean, this
we
session
may not
has
be voting
been crazy.
On them because it's big.
So we may not be voting on them after the time that we're scheduled to be done.
I think that would be fair to you and others who have committees.
Mm.
Senator Dibble, do we have the A2 amendment was offered but not voted yet? This is an author's amendment because this is the first actual hearing on the bill. On Senator Dow's motion on the A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Dow, as briefly as you, Senator Dibble, as quickly as you can.
Mr. Chairman and members, in lieu of time, you know, I won't represent all of the provisions of the bill, but suffice it to say that this has to do with those instances both in rental property and in home ownership when a foreclosure has been initiated, recognizing the dire circumstances that we're in, allowing for for folks to both stay in their rental property in the rental section when new ownership takes over through the foreclosure process, and then allowing for some provisions so there's not automatic eviction that occurs during the foreclosure process, and then allowing for a period of time under home ownership provision, the latter part of the bill, for folks to get their feet back under them for a period of 2 years. We did introduce a sunset, so it's a hard 2 years, June 30th, 2012. Then just some legal clarification, cleanup language, and the like. Mr. Chair and members, why don't we start with Mr. Bark, who told a very powerful personal story, has a little bit of an update to his story. It'll be very brief.
Thank you again, attending senators and chair. As well, you probably have heard my recent testimony not many weeks ago. But in brief, that aroused attention to our bank, our lender, and we were asked to be brought down to their office a week ago last Friday, thinking that because of this hearing and the legislature, they would work out some arrangement. So they had some concerns, and they wanted to work out something. And they asked me, what are your concerns? What would you like us to do? And I mentioned two things. I'd like you to rescind the sheriff's sale, which we're presently in, I'm sorry to mention, but a sheriff's sale has occurred, and also that you'd work out a loan modification plan for us. So with that in mind, thinking we would be invited down for this plan to take place, I was asked to attend a little meeting without any other counsel to be involved with me, and just my wife and I attended. We signed a privacy act, which I wasn't aware. I didn't have a chance to review it, but I signed something. This put this something into a motion, an agreement that they would work out a payment plan before a sheriff sale occur, which would be June 1st. We agreed upon this, but we feel that it was unnecessary for us to give them any monies. They've asked us for some monies. To prevent this and to go into this new plan, not a modification plan at all. It's a contract for deed, and it's got us really binding now. It's further complicating the issue. So, of course, I want some attention brought to this, and homeowners could get the support that we need. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, we have Peter Brown from the Minnesota Tenants Union, who's been of great assistance in drafting this concept and putting it in the shape that we have it. He can give you a very brief kind of highlight of the bill.
My name is Peter Brown, Minnesota Tenants Union volunteer attorney, and I believe in your packets may be some information specific to the counties in which you reside regarding the counts, the rates of foreclosures, and the impacts on financial impacts on local governments within your counties. Everyone says that foreclosure hurts everyone. Hurts the lender, the borrower, the property values of neighbors, the local tax base, local governments, etc. Yet, as the economic crisis has deepened and home and rental property foreclosures have mounted to historic levels in Minnesota over the past 5 years with no reasonable prospect of receding to pre-crisis levels, no effective means has been adopted to stop the bleeding. crisis-level foreclosures have damaged and continue to damage our families, our neighborhoods, our local governments, and our community fabric as Minnesotans. To get our communities through the current economic crisis as intact as possible and to provide the time and space necessary to discover the wisdom and political will to realistically buck the foreclosure juggernaut, a significant timeout from foreclosure business as usual is required. The two-year stay, the foreclosure moratorium, Section 8 of this bill, and the two-year tenant securities period, Sections 1 through 7 authorized in this bill, will provide such much-needed time out, or finger in the dike, if, as you prefer. Thank you.
Mr. Brown. Mr. Chair, Mick Kelly also wanted to share very, very brief comments.
Hello, my name is Mick Kelly. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you today. As I think all of you know, people in Minnesota, working people, are facing a crisis. And I think you all have a choice. Basically, at this moment, you can choose to stand with working people and say no to foreclosures. We need a two-year moratorium on home foreclosures, and we need to address the rights of tenants who are in foreclosed properties. A lot of work has gone into this bill. It's a common-sense way to address a real crisis that real people in the state are facing, and I hope you support it.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
That concludes our presentation, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Bankers Association. I will be brief in the light of time we have here. The MBA represents about 94% of the 420 banks in Minnesota, and my members are very active in their communities. They're civic-minded. They're employers. They're the hearts of their communities. And I just wanted to commend Senator Dibble for working on foreclosure issues and renter issues. He's a strong advocate for them, and commend him for bringing this forward. I wanted to point out that Minnesota has some of the strongest pro-consumer foreclosure laws in the country, and I do have a handout. I don't know if it made it around yet. I think staff has it, and it shows the 22 laws that we've passed and with about 70 provisions over the last 3 years, many of which the MBA has supported. So we have worked a lot on a lot of foreclosure issues. However, we do not support the moratorium bill that's before you today. I want to be clear that my members share the concerns policymakers have for the high levels of foreclosures in Minnesota. Foreclosure is a lender's last resort. A bank's goal is to provide all of a customer's financial needs throughout their lifetimes, their savings accounts, checking, CDs, all their financial products and services. Foreclosure doesn't fit that goal. Many times, lenders will wait 30, 60, 90, 120 days before commencing a foreclosure. In addition, we have one of the longest, lengthiest consumer-friendly foreclosure processes in the country. And there's also a second handout coming around that kind of lays out a sample or a potential foreclosure in Minnesota. And you'll see that the redemption period, for example, 6 months. Many states don't have a redemption period or have a very short one. Than we have here in Minnesota. So we have already a very long foreclosure process. Another point I wanted to make that Minnesota passed in 2008 a pre-foreclosure counseling notice law, which requires a lender to send a borrower's information to a counseling agency and also send a note to the borrower saying you have the right for counseling. That law has been working. The counselors are reporting that they've been able to work with thousands of Minnesotans to help them avoid foreclosure. One other point I wanted to make is that we are concerned that this legislation will have the effect of raising the cost of credit in Minnesota. Interest rate is based on risk, and if Minnesota lawmakers demonstrate that they are willing to pass laws to impact contracts already in place, lenders will have to take that into account when assessing risk. With that, I'll stop. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions? And next witness, Mr. Skilbert.
Mr. Chairman, members, David Skilbred with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota and the Statewide Association of Privately Held, Locally Owned, Locally Focused Community Banks. Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to compliment Senator Dibble on the A2 amendment. I think that goes in the right direction. And thank all of you for your work on the past four, this is year four now, that we've been dealing with responses to the foreclosure crisis. We share the concerns of the author and the proponents. Foreclosure is the last resort. As Mr. Johnson mentioned, the present foreclosure process is 420 days, or about 14 months. Last year, we changed another law that allows for the reinstatement to be extended an additional 5 months to help people catch up on past payments. It was mentioned in another hearing that regarding FHA loans and their guarantee, I just want to make it clear that those are a very small portion of the loans out there. In the first quarter of 2009, it was about 17% of all loans originated. Foreclosure is a costly business, and therefore it is the last resort for all lenders. I've heard many lenders say to me, David, I would prefer to see someone in church that I denied a loan to as opposed to someone in church that I had to foreclose on. That's the attitude that we have. One thing about this proposal is that it delays, but it does not resolve the issue, and it's going to put lenders in a very difficult circumstance as it regards examinations. Bank examiners want a clear exit strategy for a non-performing loan. If a loan is not underwritten to the standards they expect, banks will need to reserve or set aside additional funds for those loans, and in these cases for up to 2 years, plus the additional foreclosure period, plus any time after the moratorium expires to dispose of the property. That creates a capital issue for banks and removes capital that could otherwise be used for new loans. In Washington, D.C., we often hear lawmakers telling banks to make loans, make more loans to get the economy going. Bank examiners, on the other hand, who are going to our banks, are coming down very hard on loans that are made in order to do their diligence on safety and soundness. The effect of this is to be in a car and imagine one person with their foot on the gas and the other foot on the brake. That's kind of the circumstance that we find ourselves in. That'll end my comments. I'll be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Skillbred. Questions from the committee? Did you have the final witness yet as well, Mr. Boutel? Welcome to the committee.
My name is Robert Boutel. I'm an attorney who practices real estate law. I'm a volunteer here. I am on the Minnesota State Bar Real Property Section Legislation Committee. I'm not testifying as to any policies that the State Bar has adopted. I'm on a committee that's monitoring and contributing what we can to foreclosure legislation. We are not taking sides in the crisis, obviously, because we represent everybody, homeowners, lenders, tenants, landlords. And what we are concerned about in both all of these pieces would be some people who have been left out. We want to see that their interests are protected. These would be, for instance, good faith purchasers of foreclosed property and their lenders. And we need to guarantee that we can deliver clear title to people in these kinds of transactions. And we're willing to work with the authors and the advocates to clear up any of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, on this sheet here, and there's a timeline progression, where along here would this stay that we're looking at be applied for, or would that be kicked in? Is there a date or a green or a color dot I can refer to?
Mr. Chair, I've only just seen this myself, so I
the seventh payment missed or the fourth payment missed or
right. Mr. Chair, I would have to take some time with this document to absorb it and understand it on the fly here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I don't know, maybe if one of the bankers' representatives could address that. Would it be after the final 240 days or when this would be extended for the next 2 years? Or where in that process would that this piece of legislation would fit in?
Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, quite honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. My only point in bringing this sheet forward is that in our current law, we already have a very lengthy process and very consumer-friendly process with a lot of time built into it. And a moratorium seems to be geared at time, but there's already a time lengthy process in place, and I apologize for not knowing the answer to your question. I should.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higginson.
I think on page 4 it talks about after written receipt of the notice of foreclosure, which is probably the eighth payment missed, or the seventh payment missed.
That's the notice
of the sheriff's sale would be.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble, did you have your hand up?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to respond to the consumer-friendly characterization of our process. I'm sure that's the perception. I don't doubt that Mr. Johnson believes that. Nevertheless, when we heard at our more extensive hearing during the interim, the level of effort that a number of homeowners have made to initiate resolution conversations with their lender and having received absolutely no response in a fairly extensive study that shows that that's actually the case, and I think also the numbers kind of bear that out. You know, we looked at more foreclosures in some quarters of last year than the year before, and we're still looking at foreclosures continued unabated, and people continuing to report just a failure to respond from their lending institutions. I think there is sometimes a distinction, and I'm not trying to paint all these lending institutions with the same brush. There seems to be a difference among them based on certain types of institutions and who they use as intermediaries to kind of service this foreclosure process. And, you know, if we can move on from here, as I've stated in the last hearing, I will state again, if in fact we do move on to commerce, my door is wide open. To date, the only improvements to the language that we've developed have been in response to what we've heard as in the form of critique. But no one has actually come forward to sit down and really work through this bill or the language. But my door stays wide open for continuing conversation and negotiation to deal with concerns on the part of all parties and stakeholders.
Senator Torres, rather than Senator Dahl, then maybe we're ready.
Mr. Chair, could I remind you that this committee is scheduled until 2:45, and we're much over that at this point. I have a 2:45 appointment. Well, no, it's not 3 o'clock. If you look at the official schedule, okay. It's 2:45. I guess I just get frustrated when we're looking at, bills that obviously need discussion.
Take time.
And
I hear you.
I'm going to try to be very quick, Senator, so that you can take a vote on this, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, I would like to know in page 529. It says that application this section applies only to mortgages executed before the effective day of this section. And I wonder, we have had waves of foreclosures, and it is my understanding that the cities have gone through kind of the most significant kind of number right now, and so this wave is moving now to suburban, and so your district, my district, really will not benefit from this, and I wonder if you would be willing to move that so that we make it more retroactive, because cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul may not benefit from this by making it effective just for the future.
Oh, no.
It says before, not after.
Mr. Chair, I think that is the intent of this language, is to deal with mortgages that precede today and not prospective
going forward,
future mortgages.
Thank you for the clarification.
We can rework the wording.
Okay.
Thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Chair, I guess I just wanted to say I've been listening to both of these things. I know that we have a process that's been working and, sort of working, but it's a lengthy process that gives a lot of time to it. However, we're in, I guess, kind of extraordinary times, and so seems to me that this bill does still need a lot of work, but I don't think the conversation should end today. So I think we should try to move this on to at least the next stop and see if we can get some things worked out and maybe find a way to bring the two sides together that makes some sense, that we can help the consumers out there. With that, I'd like to move the bill him wherever it goes to its next stop. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dell moves the bill as amended. Sir Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we do that, I just wanted to inquire. Senator Dibble, we had some testimony here a few minutes ago about the potential effect of this being an even greater tightening of credit. And I know in the last several weeks I've had conversations with people in my district as well as outside of my district, small business owners who are feeling the crunch of not having access to capital. Is there a concern that doing these things is going to continue to exacerbate that? Is there a concern about in the attempt to do something that might be a relief to some segment of the maybe the tenants who are living in foreclosed properties, but what about the people who are trying to build businesses and cannot access capital because it gets tied up into trying to cover the risk that's inherent in the structure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, yeah, that's absolutely a concern if it's in fact true. I know it's been stated. It hasn't been actually proven to me. I mean, people say these things, but then they don't come to my office and actually show me how whether or not that's true or how that's true. And this is not a concept without precedent in the state. It's an attempt to recognize that we've tried a lot of stuff and it doesn't seem to be working really well for a lot of folks. That being said, if it's an actual concern, we'll try to deal with that. I'm sensitive to that. You know, access to credit is going to be a huge key to getting our economy back on the right track.
Senator Dowell's motion that the bill be recommended passed as amended, be recommended passed, referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Because we only have, we're not going to vote on these other bills. What I'm going to suggest is that Senator Kelash and Senator Higgins, if you wanted to make comments on your bills, we have the ability to do that. Michael Dowell is going to make an overview of the issue. And
okay. So I can say mine in about four sentences. Okay.
Senator Kelash, you can go up there. Senator Higgins, you can see where you are.
I can see where I am. Okay. Should I start?
Go ahead.
Gathering. Senate File 2520 is part of the landlord-tenant protections package, and these are the utility-related provisions. Let me start by moving the A1 amendment, which merely deletes Section 7. And if we don't have the paper of it handed out, all it does is delete Section 7 on page 8. So I would move that.
We'll act on that. We're not going to act on the bill itself, but we will act that in for the preparation. Senator Higgins moves to delete Section 7 of 2520. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. There are now four main pieces left in the bill. One is about the fair usage of utilities. In the bill, when landlords divide up a utility bill among tenants on a common meter, each tenant will now pay more precisely for the gas, electricity, or water they're using and not subsidizing another tenant or receiving a windfall from another tenant. The second piece is an accurate court file information piece. It proposes that eviction records actually reflect convictions in court and not cases where there is no court decision at all. The third piece is the allowing the termination of a lease for infirmity. In other words, if an elderly or disabled tenant is forced to move into hospice or into a nursing home, it would allow the termination of the lease as long as fair compensation is provided to the landlord. The last piece is the tenant's right to cure or vacate. Just as landlords now are given an opportunity under the law to fix a reported problem before the tenant can take them to court, this bill would allow that tenants also have the right to correct problems before they are taken to court. The exceptions are when guns, drugs, prostitution, and violent behavior is involved. We also level the playing field for both tenants and landlords when it comes to the time they are given to fix the problems and the lease violations, changing it from 14 days to 7 days. And that's my piece.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. How do you want to proceed? Do you want to Senator Kelash go briefly, or Senator Mr. Dowell, you want to go?
Okay.
Should I just move to lay mine over, or are we just going to administratively lay it over?
Members, I'm
bringing forward the Senate file 2721, modified landlord-tenant law. I do have an A1 amendment. I'm not sure if we're doing those right now, Mr. Chair.
What is the amendment been distributed?
I'll move that amendment.
Senator Dahl moves that. What's the number? A1 amendment. Senator Dahl moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, this bill places some limits on additional remedies for tenants where, even if after the tenant follows all the rules, repairs are not made in their home. Specifically, the bill caps fees for late payment of rent and security deposits, requires landlords to give receipts to tenants if they pay rent in cash or by money order, gives tenants in limited emergency situations to make repairs, the rights to make repairs on and deduct those payments from the rent, and it gives tenants the right to break a lease with notice if the landlord does not make repairs. With me is Michael Dahl from Homeline to provide the context of the bill.
Michael, you want Senator Dibble to go next? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll just brief present Senate File 2595 very quickly. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 2595 brings a number of landlord-tenant law issues up to date that have been unresolved for many, many years. It also brings our laws into conformity with the new federal renter protection law. Starting in on sections 1 and 2, what this does is allows judges to hear eviction expungement motions at the same hearing that the eviction case itself is being heard, saving the court as well as the tenant time and having to come back for a second hearing. And this is those instances when folks are having to deal with an eviction, but for good reason that eviction shouldn't follow them on their record, preventing them from accessing future housing. Section 3 deals with statewide winter heating code, establishing some standards for providing adequate heat to an adequate temperature, et cetera. Right now, that standard is kind of scattered all over statute. Section 4 just kind of evens the playing field, as it were. In those instances where a tenant is required to sign a lease, where they have to pay attorney's fees if the landlord wins a lawsuit, you know, it treats tenants the same way in the reverse circumstance. Let's see, sections 5 and 6 deals with this issue of screening fees, applicant fees, et cetera, really trying to address those array of issues that crop up. There are some instances where application and screening fees are being collected as a way, if I dare say, as a way of making money. And so it just tries to deal with a number of issues and circumstances to make sure that screening fees are only being, or application fees are only being collected in those instances when someone really does have a fair shot at being accepted as a renter, that is being used specifically for screening and credit and criminal background check purposes, et cetera. Provides for some of those provisions where it needs to be repaid, how it gets repaid, why it might be repaid, et cetera. So just provides for some cleanup of that process and tries to address some of the abuses in that. Section 7, kind of a reflection of my past bill, kind of a little bit of a turnabout, though. It gives those tenants who are in a foreclosed property the right to terminate their lease. Let's see, Section 8 just simply says that a landlord or a tenant, if there's a breach of a lease, must use an attempt to repair and mitigate damages, including looking for someone to sublease the property. And then finally, moving on to Section 10, this has to do with the amount of time that someone is given to vacate, particularly in those instances when there's a foreclosure circumstance. And that's the 30,000-foot, very quick, high-level overview, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Then because of the time, I'm not going to go through mine right now, but I have Mr. Dowell go ahead and begin.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl, and I'm Public Policy Director with Homeline. I had some great testimony lined up. You're going to miss it out on it. But anyway, Homeline is a statewide nonprofit organization that provides free legal advice to tenants so they can solve their own rental housing problems. We've been providing this advice for 17 years. We know the issues that are being faced by tenants, and we track what is happening across the state by issue area and zip code. In 2009, we handled 11,000 calls from tenants who are having difficulties in resolving situation with their landlords. Sometimes the landlord's wrong, and we let them know that, but there are a significant subset of cases where we think Minnesota law is mushy. It's not precise, and it's actually creating conflict between tenants and landlords, and we want to correct that. The proposals that are before you, I have to point out, they're based on laws in other states in almost every case. And in one case, 42 other states have laws protecting tenants that Minnesota doesn't provide. And because tenant-landlord law hasn't gone through a major revision for the last 20 years, there's a lot of proposals before you that we're trying to address. I just want to tell you what a couple of those ideas are. One, if you pay with cash or money order, you get a receipt from your landlord. That there be a statewide heat code, because if you live in Duluth, the city ordinance says that you can live in an apartment at 68 degrees. In Hermantown, they don't really say. There's no guidance about what is the proper temperature to live in that apartment. We think there should be a statewide heat standard. We also bring up the case that we think that if a landlord files a complaint against a tenant, that not go on their record until a judge has actually ruled against them. Right now, we're seeing tenants having the simple accusation from a landlord follow them forever. I want to point out that most landlords are good landlords. Most landlords do everything that we say in these proposals, but some do not, and that's what this proposal is about. If I can just give a couple of moments to our two testifiers who've been here since this morning just to say their particular situation, and then lastly to note that we are meeting with the Multi-Housing Association, trying to come to some common ground, hoping that we can bring a proposal before this committee and Judiciary Committee for what it is we will become law at the end of this session.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you. My name is Peggy Larkin, and I'm a tenant in a rental community in Maple Grove. I've been waiting all day to testify in support of the Tenants' Bill of Rights and to tell you why it's important to me and my family. In light of time, I'm just going to quickly tell you one example that I have and how it relates to a couple components of the bill. Two times, my landlord has come to me and told me that I owed several months' rent dating back 4 years. It was very difficult and time-consuming to prove that I had paid that rent, and it happened to me twice. I think that if I were given receipts for my payments, it would have been a much easier thing to prove. I think that's very simple. We get receipts all the time as consumers, and it should be done. I also think that if they were required to tell me or tell renters about a complaint before it goes to court, that would benefit a situation similar to mine in that it can be corrected. In my case, it was an error. It was not me not paying my rent, and this would solve it before it went to court. And I just want to ask you to level the playing field, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Garza. Were some of those payments paid in cash, the ones with?
Some were in money order. Most of mine were in checks, so I was able to go back to the bank.
The money order ones would be harder.
Yeah, I did actually find them, but yeah, it was a difficult process.
Thank you. Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Senator, for letting me be here to talk today. When I was asked to speak today, I wasn't really sure where to begin, so I thought I would start with a question for myself. And the question for myself was, have I ever felt that I have failed as a mother, as a parent, and as a shelter provider for my child? On December 3rd, when my 3-year-old and I had to live, eat, and sleep, and breathe in mold due to our flooding apartment, I seriously had felt that I had failed. But then I realized it wasn't really I who had failed. My landlord actually failed. There's one major fact that any renter could tell you, and that's that landlords are a part of your life every day. They affect our health, they affect our children, our jobs, our future in renting, and now they even affect our credit scores. Reality is that they affect every aspect of our life. like I had mentioned, my apartment had flooded on December 1st, and they had Anoka County come in and fix my apartment on December 24th, Christmas Eve, because our landlord had failed. We were living in sewage. It just was the most unbelievable thing I had ever been through. We filed emergency tenancy remedy acts. Nothing was done. And it's just something that if the landlord would have done what he was supposed to do, if he would have had consequences or we would have had some type of rights, then they would have been fixed. Some of the things that I have experienced since I've lived there, and I've only been there 6 months, for the whole month of December, I was pretty much out of water. Our heat was gone. We had sewer overflowing. I've had threats of our electricity being shut off by the utility company and our water again because our landlord can't afford to pay the bills. I had a wrongful eviction put against me by my landlord. Not only did he not show up for court, but his filing fees bounced. And the list goes on. I mean, we have drugs that are allowed in our apartment. Work orders ignored all the time. My mailbox was tampered with. Keys not allowed. I had to file a police report to even get a mailbox key for my new apartment. The stuff that I've been through is just absolutely ridiculous. And I think that if some of these laws would pass and landlords were actually responsible to take care of us as renters, then I think that nobody would ever have to go through what I went through.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard.
Are you still in that apartment? Yeah. Have they fixed them now?
The whole entire first floor is completely demolished. They made everybody from the first floor move up to the third or second floor, but everybody has pretty much vacated and left. As a single mom, I make $8 an hour. I don't have the means to move out right now.
Thank you. Because I apologize for, we scheduled too many things today, and I apologize for shortchanging all of these. I will encourage the association to meet with the multi-housing association to try and work out some things, because I think our laws have been so far behind the times on this, and the thing that people don't have to give receipts and so on. I think these are issues we have to address, so I will strongly encourage Homeline and the multi-housing association to try and work something out, because I know these aren't issues that should wait for another session, and I also know we're going to have some sort of work on this, so I hope that you can sit down very quickly and try and work out some differences on this, because on all four of these bills. Is there any Senator Dibble or Senator Keegash, any last comments? Or?
Look forward to seeing you again soon.
Pardon?
I look forward to seeing you again soon.
With that, I apologize to the committee as well for running long. Thank you. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.